Our Dharma talk this morning will be given by Boundless Way Dharma teacher Alan Richardson.
It's wonderful to be with you all this morning. It feels very warm inside now, and it's so bitterly cold outside. Great contrast. And I thought I would start by mentioning how we seem to have a family style at Boundless Way Zen in giving talks. We talk about sutras and koans and other Buddhist writings that are meaningful to us. And we also talk about our lives. We talk about our lives not in an abstract sense, but from just where we are as we give the talk. And that seems so right to me, because if the sutras don't speak to our lives and don't touch us where we are at this moment, then they're just words in a book. They're not alive. So I thought I would talk about a couple of passages from the sutra book, the new sutra book, and how they speak to me these days, and today in particular. And one of the passages was in our sutra book before, and so it's familiar to us, and one of them is new. So the familiar one, which we all just recited together, is the first paragraph from Days Like Lightning by Taigo Bowu, who was a 14th century Korean great teacher. And so I'll just read this first paragraph to you. The days and months go by like lightning. We should value the time. We pass from life to death in the time it takes to breathe in and breathe out. It's hard to guarantee even a morning and an evening. Whether walking or standing, sitting or lying down, do not waste even a minute. Become ever braver and bolder. Be like our original teacher, Shakyamuni, who kept on progressing energetically. So this is a sutra that we often read during Sesshin, and I'll tell you that every time I recite it, every time I hear it, part of the reaction for me is just this feeling of terrible inadequacy. Do not waste even a minute. Oh, come on. You know, and I think it's an occupational hazard, especially for those of us who are lay Buddhists, to feel that we are wasting all kinds of minutes. Knowing perfectly well that you can be in a monastery and be the proverbial rice bag and you know, waste plenty of time that way still. At least you're in the monastery. You're doing the bows. You're doing the sutras. You're sitting. And those of us in lay life, which is most of us in Boundless Way Zen, may often find ourselves doing things that don't feel at all like practice. And when I come here to coming and going Sesshin, again, pretty much every time, part of what happens to me is the same old story, which is that I come for, you know, a morning and an evening and maybe a morning, and I see other people who are here for 3 weeks, and part of me says, I should be here for 3 weeks. I should be like our original teacher. And be progressing energetically, and what is it in my life that prevents this? And there's plenty. You know, there are classes to teach, and exams to grade, and proposals to write, and dissertations to read waiting for me. And also, there are plenty of things that have nothing to do with duty. Recently, my great activity was watching the Saturday Night Live 40th reunion show with my beloved and drinking beer and laughing and welcoming a new cat into her home whose owner had died, and helping it feel comfortable and adjust to the hissing and growling resident cat. And these things should be great activities too, yeah, but so tempting not to not to feel that they are. So tempting to think that the real practice life is going on someplace else. in the temple in some super austere monastery in Japan. And lately, actually almost for a year now, I've especially felt that maybe I'm not being serious enough, because the last year I've been really, really happy. And, you know, so where's that impetus? and for various reasons, I got out of a very stressful situation about a year ago, and that in itself it just made ordinary life seem so lovely. And I had the semester off last. It was my sabbatical semester after 7 years of waiting, and I got to do something I'd been wanting to do for years, which was to spend a whole month in the woods hiking the Appalachian Trail in Virginia. And I had this theory that October was the perfect month to hike in Virginia, and it was true, and I just had such a wonderful time. And work's been going well, and I found myself in a relationship with the person I had dreamt of for 40 years. Who knew that such person really existed? Mm. And, you know, and I turned 60 this year. How tempting to think, oh, it won't happen. So life surprises us, and it can surprise us in ways that make us absurdly happy. I took on what I thought would be a miserable, difficult job with Boundless Way Zen, and it turned out to be really fun. I had written my resignation letter before I even started. And there it is, collecting dust in my desk drawer. So, you know, so David will remember that during October Sesshin, I even said to him, you know, where's the suffering? What's maybe this whole dukkha thing is being oversold. And of course, the moment one says that, a couple things arise. One is that even in our times of happiness, all we have to do is walk out the palace gates, and we will see sickness and old age and abject poverty and death. And the other thing that arises right away is, it's like that song, "Don't go looking for trouble, trouble will find you." You know, don't go looking for dukkha, dukkha will find you. All we have to do is wait. And sure enough, I had a couple of experiences recently that really brought that home to me. One was, I was cross-country skiing with my beloved friend after coaxing her to try this again after many years. And we were having a great time in one of my favorite places in the world, which is the Pinkham Notch area in the White Mountains. And she seemed to be doing great and picking it right up, and I was coaxing her down a little hill, and she didn't really want to do it, but no, you'll be fine. And suddenly she had fallen and got up and said, I think I've broken my cheekbone. And I said, oh, no, nobody breaks their face cross-country skiing. And then as the bruise began to develop and, you know, the blood oozed out, I started to think, well, maybe we should head back to the lodge. And, you know, and shortly afterwards, we were in the emergency room in North Conway. And, yeah, two orbital bones had been broken. And there were, you know, brain scans going on just in case. And, you know, there it was. You know, there's that days like lightning moment where you go from ridiculous happiness to real suffering, and the temptation to feel tremendous guilt and wallow in it for weeks to come. And then not long after, about when the bruises had healed, and these bruises look like, you know, the result of a prize fight with some heavyweight. But as the bruises healed, then it was my turn. We were having another great weekend in New York City, which is another of my favorite places to go. And I got out of bed in this nice hotel we got a great deal on, and had this terrible pain running down my sciatic nerve, and suddenly looked at my thigh, and it was covered with sores, and I had the shingles. And there, it just came out of nowhere. You know, any one of us who had chicken pox as a kid, this can happen. And so here I was literally all pocked up. And again, just, you know, momentarily, we don't have to worry that suffering somehow went away. Suffering is always there, and it has ways of finding us. Now, it may seem like the place that I'm going to is to say, so I, you know, lived in a false paradise for a while and let myself forget about the first noble truth and my practice relax a little bit. No, that's not where I'm going at all. Not at all. What happened was very different. What happened was that when these things, when these instances of suffering arose, they really weren't that awful. One of the things that struck me so forcibly when my friend hurt herself was I was, you know, waiting for the reproaches and waiting for the subtle things to come. Well, you know, I told you, no, nothing like that happened. And then I was waiting for my own reactivity to spring up and waiting for me to be defensive and overly blaming myself, hoping for absolution. And I realized very, very quickly, I didn't have to do this. And that was actually just okay for her to be hurt and for me to take care of her. That there was a perfectly straight path to take. And I could just let go of all my usual, you know, self-limiting reactions and just try to see how I could make things better and be okay insofar as there were things I couldn't make better. And when I got the shingles, once more attempted to think, well, you know, this is going to go on for months, and I heard about somebody that had this for 5 years, and instead it was just, no, this is kind of, it's not so bad. Let's see where it goes. I can still walk. I can still do the things I want to do. This pain is not unbearable. And I found that I could be okay, much more okay than I would have imagined, with either someone else's pain or with my own pain. And so I was very moved when I was looking through the new sutra book, and I found this reading that we read together, Spring Everywhere, by Shundo Aoyama, from the book Zen Seeds. And she is a living Japanese teacher. And so let me read it to you again. Happiness that depends on what you acquire or become is only conditional happiness, not true happiness. True happiness means no matter what happens, it's all right. If you become ill, just be ill. When it's time to die, just die. Unless you accept your present circumstances, happiness cannot be attained. To face any situation and accept it with open arms molds the attitude, enabling you to see that a wonderful way of living is possible. This is indeed something of consequence. As soon as this attitude is achieved, you have reached paradise, anytime, anywhere, and in any circumstances. It is the plum blossoms that bring the spring. Once this idea is accepted, spring must be everywhere. It might sound like these two readings are contradicting each other, but I don't think so. I think that they're saying something very similar. That they are giving us two ways to understand that every moment is precious, and that we are constantly being given opportunities to fully engage with our lives and with our practice. There are Dharma gates in great acute suffering, and there are Dharma gates in ridiculous happiness. And there are Dharma gates in ordinary everyday suffering and in ordinary everyday happiness. There are Dharma gates in sitting at the temple for Ango, or in going to that austere monastery in Japan, and there are Dharma gates in our condos and in our one family or three family homes, and all of them are there to be entered into. So when we vow together, Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. This is the vow that we're making. We don't need to be anywhere else or to be in any other state or to be anyone else. How wonderful for us that Dharma gates are boundless. What a great opportunity. And again, what a great opportunity for me to be sitting here with you today. Thank you.
So I invite you to sit comfortably. Now we have what we call our Dharma dialogue. So it's an opportunity to come forward with questions about the talk or the reading, about practice, or about observations for what's alive for you in this moment of practice life.
I find that I have this suffering imbalance in a way. Like, when it's about me, like, if something, you know, like, if I get hurt or something happens to me, I'm like, oh, okay, that's fine, you know. If you have to die, die, or whatever. But if it's somebody else, like my wife or a child, you know, then I'm, like, totally in the whole suffering moment and going crazy, you know, about it. And I don't know what to think about that. you know, I sometimes wish I'd give myself a little bit more consideration in that sense, to say, like, yeah, you know, something bad happened to me, you know, I should really not just take, you know, turn the other cheek necessarily, and, you know, feel more about that.
So. Yeah. A lot of things come up for me, and I'll just say a few of them. And, you know, and one of them is, yeah, it especially when you mention your children, you know, it's such a natural human reaction to say, you know, let it be me. And anyone that you love, you know, let it be me. And that's okay. You know, I think that there's a real, that there's something to honor in that impulse. At the same time, you know, that there's this is a way too of separating ourselves. You know, that it is you, you know. and that's partly why it hurts so much. That this is a chance for us to see the truth of no self, to see the truth of no separation.
There's another even teaching underlying this that comes to mind for me. I think what you said is so important about not separating, and also not having the slight misunderstanding that the way I'm reacting to suffering is wrong. You know, so Alan told us this beautiful story where he was beginning to let go of some of his old reactivity, and so you notice this imbalance. But that imbalance is the reality of your life right now. So you don't have to make it different. You know, that's we think we always have to make things different. You know, we all want to be like Alan. I wish I could be like Alan. But we can only be like ourselves, and it's important. Even if we're this, you know, this whole thing about letting go doesn't mean that we stop being reactive. So it could be that, you know, the next terrible thing that happens, Alan just runs around in circles screaming. That would not be a failure of the practice. That would be him running around, and if he can just be with that, right? So if you can be with this imbalance and not even look at it that way. Kind of interesting. Look at me. And then take the lesson that Alan just showed us about not separating. Of course it's you. It's always you. Yeah.
So what comes up for me, I love both responses from Melissa and Alan about Mark's question, but something slightly different comes up for me. And that is that a big part of our practice is also intention, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, we pay attention to how we are, and we probably see some areas that we don't like. And it's completely true that we don't need to do anything about that in the moment other than to see it. But it's also a part of our practice to say, oh, you know, so I would like to do something a little different in this area, right? And to keep that in mind, you know. So this is an area that it may be fruitful for me to look at, right? And to watch. And that it's the looking at this and really, you know, investigating what this whole area is like, that whole new possibilities open up for us without having to do anything ourselves. But great that you notice this, right? This is an area that you'd like to pay attention to and perhaps have change. And I think that's a wonderful thing. That's our living by vow that we talk about, you know? Yeah, intention, very important part of our lives.
And I like how important it is, this acceptance we're talking about, as the starting point for actually investigating. Because mm-hmm. usually we see something and I think, oh, that's bad. I have to be different or I have to change. So from this place of, wow, this is how it is right now, then there's a possibility of investigation that's not a moral inquiry into am I okay, will I be okay, but more freedom than that to look in, oh, what is going on? What do I intend? And it just seems like it takes some of the pressure off of it, because then it's not about me, it's about, well, what? It's curiosity. What is going on here? Isn't that interesting? What are other possibilities? So wonderful. Appreciate you bringing this up.
And you know that all these coming together, this is like the whole life of practice, you know, that both these texts were talking about. And I think that there is, Alan was really pointing us to the fruits of practice. When you really recognize and intend, you're surprised. Right? And then the important thing then isn't to concretize that surprise, but continually be surprised. It's spring everywhere. It really is. And I was talking to somebody else the other day who said something very similar to Alan, that sometimes we cling to our old life of unhappiness even though we seem to be happy because we don't trust it. Mm-hmm. Right? And there's a little bit of that. And I think you've learned to trust it a little more, at least as long as it's arising. This happiness that isn't conventional happiness. Mm-hmm. So there is that promise. But there's no strategy to get there. Mm-hmm. Sorry. This isn't a strategy, what we just outlined for
you. Liz and then Kate.
What's striking me in all these comments and your talk, Alan, is the tension between effort and letting go. And I feel like I understand each of those somewhat in isolation, but trying to understand how mm-hmm. to have both interacting at once. So I, too, was really struck in the sutra book by that line, when you get sick, just be sick, and when you die, just die. And that's so striking and beautiful. But then I start thinking, well, what about if you broke your legs in the woods, and would you just sit there and die? No, that's not quite the lesson. But like figuring out, okay, what is the lesson? When do you just die? And when do you strive really hard not to die? Or any variation on that?
So I think we value this place that you just manifested. Of that's a real question. Right, and it's alive for you, and it's alive for every one of us. And there is no answer, or no one answer. There is answer after answer. And we so value the individual experience and practice to discover, you know, and we get it wrong or we get it right all the time. But to, well, what is it? How? What is called for now? Right? And you know, Melissa said this is not a strategy, that there isn't a rule book on this. This is exactly saying any rule we make up, and we want to make up the new great rule that will guide us. But the rule is to be present, and there are no rules. but thank you, you bring, you know, so that spirit of inquiry. So what is it? What is it? We can take with us on the cushion. What is it? What is it? Yeah.
And then sometimes we get, oh, it's this. And then we proceed for a while with that idea, and then we realize we're wrong. Whoops. That's also part of it. It's just this constant risk-taking of coming forward and being wrong as well. This phrase, letting go, is very problematic in English because it really emphasizes the letting part of it, the allowing, letting things go. We might say letting things come and go. But the way it's come into pop psychology is getting rid of. And it doesn't mean getting rid of at all. It really, you know, the idea, I always do things like this, you know, the letting go is like, let it go, you know, drop it. But what we're doing instead is we're opening the hand of thought. We're just like, oh, what is it? What is it? You know, it's not about getting rid of. It'll go on its own. Everything comes and goes. It's one of the names of this. That's what we changed the name of this retreat to, the coming and going session. We had no idea how powerful that name was going to be because everything comes and goes. So this is the true happiness, I think, that author was talking, that she was talking about. It's just sort of this, it's like a release. But sometimes we do throw things down and sometimes we hold things tight. That's it too. But there's no escape. It's all part of the whole thing.
Maybe somewhat in response to that, my first comment is shingles vaccine. You can do something.
But isn't it only 80% effective or something?
I'll take that.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's only
20% effective.
Oh, it's only 20%. I knew there was a. It's only 20% effective. But
I'll take that too.
I'll so take that too.
Yeah. 1 out of 5.
Could be you.
What came up for me is how, oppositely, I come to all this. Oh, well, first let me say, I really appreciated everything. Yeah, I felt like you spoke for me and probably many of us when you're talking about the difficulties of lay practice, because we don't have a strong model for that, right? It's fairly new. All these old writings are from monks and monasteries. So we're kind of making it up as we go, and every talk that addresses it is helpful. You know, we get to hold it up one more time and look and see what works for us and what doesn't. So I really appreciate you pointing back to what you do in your life outside of here and from sitting on the cushion. And for me, this tends to be... It's not so much that I notice imbalances as that I get bludgeoned by them. It really takes a lot for me to pay attention. And the wonderful thing is that life keeps offering up the messages. So what I particularly noticed recently it was that with all the snow that we've had, and that it's tremendously difficult to get anywhere from, especially south of Boston, if you have to work in Boston, because it was just inundated with snow, and all the public transportation is down. So after about a week of just every time I had to go into work or come home, it felt such a struggle. You know, waiting for the train, and they wouldn't tell you if it was canceled or not, you know, and so should I wait on the train platform where it's like 7 degrees, it's really cold, or should I go down and take my chance with the buses, which will just be in gridlock traffic, or, you know, should I just go home and forget it? And every day, this, ugh. And one day, this past week, I was it was, you know, 6 in the morning, way earlier than I usually get there because you just had to give yourself extra time. And I was walking out to the train platform because today's roulette was going to be, I bet, on the train, right? And as I was walking, there was this big snowbank, which was everywhere, but someone had written with their finger into the snowbank because I hadn't gotten the message any other way. You know? So we'll just tell you. And it was this big image of male genitalia, and then the words, "Fuck this snow." And I thought, oh yeah, that's really how I've been approaching it. And it's so painful. Because the snow's just doing what snow does. It falls in New England, and sometimes a lot. And so as I walked out to the platform, and it was really cold that morning, and you know, we all looked like Russian peasants or something, with everything we owned wrapped around us out there on the station. And I found that it was better not to stand still, because then you just get colder. So I would do this long walk up to the end of the platform and back. And you know, having seen that message, and again, no sign of any train or, you know, whatever, I thought, this, you know, maybe I can approach it a different way. And I began to do this fast Kenyan back and forth. And there's that sort of melty feeling, you know, of you're not fighting it anymore. And I thought, this is such a splendid morning. It's so, you know, the darkness and cold is so brilliant and sharp. I thought I would never forget this day as I walked. And as I did that, other people started to walk too. It's the most wonderful thing. And then the train came. So just how that moment can change, if only we would notice it.
Yeah. Thank you, Kitty. I loved a couple of things about what you said, and you know, one is, what an unlikely Dharma gate, right? This big graffito, yeah, of a penis. So, it's almost like somebody said, "Hey, practice with this," and you found a way to do it. So that's great. And also, I appreciated what you said about, you know, that the fact that we don't have much in the Buddhist tradition about lay practice, and I do, and you know, and here I've been thinking about Boundless Way Zen as an institution this year, and I think that what we're doing is like really, really, really important. In a, you know, here in America, is that we're for the first time, you know, a whole culture is involved in trying to create a very different kind of Buddhism. And you know, there aren't a lot of signposts, and it's, you know, we don't know in advance where it's going to end up. But I think it's great work that we're all doing together.
Just in case you don't know, Alan is the president of Boundless Way Zen.
The terrible job he took.
He said yes to. We're so grateful.
Maybe a good place to stop. Thank you.
Thank you.